Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning met when they were both first-year students in architecture at University College Dublin in the mid-1970s. Nowadays, John Toomey is Professor of Architectural Design at UCD and together with Sheila O'Donnell runs their award-winning architectural practice, O'Donnell and Toomey. Sheila also teaches at UCD and they're both members of Eas Thána. They also just recently picked up the 2013 Icon Architectural Practice of the Year Award in London. Wherever you go on the island of Ireland, you'll see their critically acclaimed buildings. The Irish Film Institute in Temple Bar was their first commission. They won the competition to build the Glucksmann Gallery at University College Cork and they designed the landmark, the New Lyric Theatre in Belfast, which opened in 2011. Their partnership extends beyond architecture. They're married to each other and they have two sons. John Toomey, Sheila O'Donnell, you're both really welcome.
Thank you.
When did you know you wanted to be an architect, John?
All my life. I mean, I never imagined I'd be anything else. People used to ask me when I was young, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I used to say, I'm going to be an architect. But I'd never met an architect. I didn't really know what an architect was.
Do you think maybe because your dad was a site engineer, I think, that you were on building sites a lot and maybe that gave you some kind of a grow?
I grew up in the world of buildings. He was a site engineer for John Paul Construction. So he would build a pier or a factory or a drainage system or a chimney or a bridge or something. We would move on a biannual basis. I was born in Tralee and then we lived in Drumshambo in Leitrim and then we lived in Macroom in Cork and then we lived in Cove and then we lived in Cooley and, you know, we moved up and down the country when I was small, very small.
Where didn't you live? In other words, you went all around the country.
Dublin. Not Dublin.
Did you mind all that moving?
I loved it, to be honest. The only thing I kind of remember, because I was young when we were moving, is that strange feeling of having a slightly different accent than the person sitting beside me in school, you know, having a Drumshambo accent in Cove or something. But otherwise, I think I was itchy to move on.
And you, Sheila, when did you think you wanted to be an architect?
In school, I really loved art and English and maths, and I was kind of trying to balance what do you do with those interests. And sometimes I thought, will I be an artist? Will I be a writer? And I somehow knew that I wasn't going, maybe I didn't have the singularity for those things. And so it sort of gradually just became the case that I wanted to be an architect. And a bit like John, I had absolutely no idea what exactly an architect does. But I just had this sense, I'll be an architect. But then when I crossed the threshold of UCD School of Architecture in whenever it was, 1971, I just thought, this is it. This is my life. This is where I belong.
And you both teach in UCD now. Can you teach someone to be an architect?
You do teach people some things, I think. But teaching allows you to keep learning yourself. It's an exchange. Somebody asks you a question and you think, okay, I can take two steps back and just about put together why it has to be that way. And I actually think it keeps you a little bit livelier than you would if you weren't. The students are part of a conversation. I don't think of them as being empty and us being full and us filling their emptiness. It's an exchange, I think.
You can really encourage and you can kind of uncover things in people. And actually, there are quite a lot of skills and technical things that you do need to learn. And that's also quite important because what I find is that if you can help people to gain a sense of technique, that gives them confidence to think and to sort of spread their own wings and be sure of what they want to do.
Because I assume it's all about ideas at the end of the day. And also, is it important to like what they're doing and their ideas?
Maybe in schools of architecture, we just have to make sure that people understand that, you know, they can love architecture. It's very, very, very interesting. It sort of warps your mind, I think. You know, once you fall through the trapdoor or come through the window or whatever happens when you start studying architecture, everything is slightly different. You know, you sit on top of a bus, you look out the window and you see a roof and you realise you're condemned to that the rest of your life. Nothing will ever look like it used to anymore.
As John says, you're sort of never neutral then because you almost can't stop yourself from thinking about why was it like that or how did that happen or who made it.
I mean, when I was thinking about people looking out the window, I think sometimes people think architects look at domes and towers, but actually they hardly ever look at anything like that. You're much more interested in a doorstep or how the lock gates on the canal work, you know, how a contraption works.
But every time, say, you visit someone's house or go anywhere, are you literally looking at their doorstep? I'm actually going to look at my own doorstep when I go home. I've never noticed it.
You know, it's funny. I think you don't do it going inside people's houses. I mean, I think, you know, you are able to kind of control the sense of the occasion you're at. But certainly when we go away travelling to a foreign city or something, I mean, we're probably totally obsessed with little walls. I mean, when we go to Greece quite a lot on holidays.
Greece,
you see, they've got amazing steps and little low walls and things that are to do with defining outdoor space and landscape and thresholds to buildings, which are to us endlessly fascinating. And we often think it's lucky that we're both married to each other, to an architect, because someone who wasn't an architect would probably go on holidays with one of us and think, I can't believe you're looking at another doorstep. You know, what's going on here?
You know, when you go to Dunleary Pier, you think you love the sea, but actually you just love the way the sea hits the stone. Take the stone away and the sea is flat, you know.
I'm going to notice that the next time.
You love your doorstep, Miriam.
Did you sit opposite Sheila? Is that how you met? Did you meet in UCD?
We did meet in UCD, yeah. We sat in the same room.
John was in the corner behind a kind of screen he built around himself, and I was in the middle of the studio. And yeah, we became good friends from first year, I think. But we didn't start going out with each other until really the very end. But I think we had a significant meeting on the stairs in Belfield one Saturday night. Belfield used to have this great Saturday night thing. Everybody went, it was a dance or a club. And one Saturday, very early in first year, I think I was going down the stairs and John was going up, and we met on a landing and we just had a conversation. And we only knew each other slightly, you know, so that's him, that's her. And something about that conversation, I think we realised there was some kind of kindred spirit thing, which I have to say, in my part, didn't really recognise as being a kind of life's companion thing. I thought, he's a very interesting guy.
It was our first
So then I went off and went out with someone else. But
she was a girl with very long hair, parted in a dead straight line down the centre. So I'd seen her in the studio. You know, and also
you spotted her.
Yeah, you have to introduce this regime. You have to introduce yourself in those days, not anymore, in the studio by saying who you are. And I sort of saw who she was. And so maybe it was the second week in college and I was coming up the stairs in Belfield and we met on the half landing and we talked for quite a long time.
About what, though? What did you talk that it was a significant meeting?
Just new to college kind of conversation. It was a fantastic conversation. Anyway, I remember coming up the stairs out of that conversation and thought, I'm going to marry her.
That's such a nice story. But meanwhile, you went out with someone else.
Well, I did. But, you know, I'd been at a single-sex school and I hadn't been out with many people. And, you know, you come to college and, you know, you have to live your life and meet lots of people. And actually, in retrospect, maybe it was quite good for us that we weren't going out with each other when we were students, because I think that's somehow a very intense thing. And maybe it was good that we both went out with other people in the year we were in, because probably almost nobody in architecture moved outside that studio. And then by the time we got to fifth year, the guy I was going out with was very nice and very charming, lovely person. But he and I had realised we just weren't for each other. And John and I had been becoming more friendly and...
We ran away together. We were kind of dissatisfied with, you know, everything around us, including the entire university structure and all that sort of stuff that gets you when you're young. So we decided we just head off the week after we left college, which must have been a colossal disappointment to Sheila's father, because Sheila's father was handing out the degrees on the podium that year. And we were gone. You know, we didn't come back to get conferred or anything like that. We just ran away. And we went to Italy to find out something about architectural history, or maybe find out something about each other. Mm-hmm. And then Sheila went to Holland and I went to Paris, hung out in different places across the summer. And gradually our paths kind of led us towards London. And before we knew it, we moved in a flat together in London without ever having really made a strong policy about it. It was more important to run away than our parents found out that we not come home to get conferred, but we were living in a basement flat in Tufnell Park.
Did your father forgive you, Sheila, for not turning up?
I think he did. Mm. And when I did my master's in London years later, at the end of the time in London, I actually have a hazy memory, but I think he may have come along to that ceremony, but probably slightly... Slightly, he would have commented, though. You know, he wouldn't have let it pass that I had not turned up to UCD for my conferring.
That was when I heard that he had been giving out the degrees. He told me, we were both sitting together as Sheila's conferring at the RCA, and he said, you know, I would have given her our degree in UCD.
If you turned up the pair
exactly,
of you.
Yeah.
But it was, you were only 17, were you then, when you went in first year in UCD?
I was, yeah, yeah.
So, right. And 2 weeks after you went in, when you met her for that significant meeting on the stairs, you said, that's the woman I'm going to marry.
That's right, yeah.
That's pretty formidable for a 17-year-old.
Now, it is possible that I might have thought that about any number of people.
This is my theory, Miriam.
No.
Because I'm an enthusiast. But in this case, it's true and has never been any different.
And when did he tell you that?
Well, I think he told me after we finally did get together, but he may contend that he told me before that. But he did have quite a lot of girls to go out with, though, before we could settle in. You know, John always had great enthusiasm for, he always had a girlfriend, I think from the time he was about 10. So he was more practiced in those things than I was. And actually, I thought he was only 17. Just as you said, I thought he was very young.
Not only was I 17, which sounds young, but I was a very young 17, I think. Had a lot to learn.
Which brings us nicely to our first piece of music this morning, which is a Bob Dylan track, is it?
So it is.
Tell me about it and why you want it.
It's a great song, but why I want it is because when I came to college, I had this feeling of landing in the metropolis. You know, I lived in these various parts of Ireland, all right, but Dublin was a distant kind of, you know, wonderful
exotic
place. I must have been only a few weeks in college, and I went to a folk club in a basement in Parnell Square. That felt, even going downstairs, you know, that felt kind of brave. And it was, everyone in there looked like they'd been there all their lives. And there was a little kind of gathering of people around this empty stage, and people would come up and play songs and sing. And in those days, I used to play the guitar and sing a bit. And this young guy, young, you know, 15 maybe, sat in a stool and sang this song. And I just could not believe it. I thought, Christ, how can he write a song like that? He's only 15. I haven't done anything. You know, I was just wiped out by that. And I was coming out of the folk club thinking, imagine doing that. Then later on, I discovered it's a Bob Dylan song, you know, and everyone knew it. Yeah. So, but it's a beautiful song, and it reminds me of my innocence and my enthusiasm and my feeling of landing on the earth when I came to Dublin.
And it's called?
I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine.
I dreamed I saw St. Augustine alive as you are me, tearing through these quarters in the utmost misery.
Tell it to me again.
I put my fingers against the glass and bowed my head and cried.
Yeah, he's a poet, of course.
Yeah.
That, of course, because people would want to know, is I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine by Bob Dylan. In 100 years, if you were to be remembered for one building or one part of what you do as architects, from your point of view, John, what would it be? Would it be a particular building or a particular part of your
project? I don't know,
because
I think thoughts run on through buildings. It's like families. And certainly there probably are things that I wouldn't mind forgetting myself. And I have to tell you that every time you finish a building, you avoid that street for at least 5 years. You know, it's quite good for us that a lot of our buildings aren't in our home city, so we don't have to look at them.
Why is that?
Because you want to do them again and change them and start again. But I think there's a little chain of buildings in our... There's the Irish Film Centre, there's the Ranelagh School, there's the Glucksman Gallery, there's the Lyric Theatre. And now there's this thing we're doing in London, the London School of Economics. You might say that's too many, but I would pick that out as a little chain of stuff that stand for thoughts we had. I mean, Sheila and I work in a kind of conversation, and I think these projects are the kind of points that you can say are the focus points of that conversation.
And for you, Sheila?
Yeah, I mean, since we do work in a conversation, and and John has listed quite a chain of things, obviously I would have some of the same thoughts. I think that thinking about the relationship between the inside and the outside of buildings and how you move from inside to outside, literally, or how just by the way you design a room and its windows, you can bring the outside in, is something that I feel is kind of a recurring theme in buildings we're doing, like individual houses or schools or even in the Lyric Theatre, where the way that we tried to make big windows that look out and bring the Lagan River into the bar, into the foyer spaces. So I think that sense of the connection between the interior of a building and the place in which it sits, which I suppose is also trying to say you want the buildings you make to sit easily in the places where they are. So I think that's to do with not thinking of them as objects, but more thinking of them as being kind of embedded.
See, the thing what people don't appreciate in Ireland is we are blessed with the most beautiful climate that it's possible to have, I think. I love the Irish climate. And
there isn't love it?
I absolutely do. And I think there isn't enough space in our buildings for us to enjoy the rain and to get shelter from the sunshine. And these in-between kind of porches and canopies and standing around in sheds, I think, you know. Probably the parts of our buildings we like are the bits that are the result of those in between that don't belong to anybody.
Contingent space. This idea that you can come up to a building and you can kind of stand in a bit where you don't have to commit to going in yet, and you don't feel nervous, and you don't feel that bit where you're afraid you'll go in the door and someone will say, hello, can I help you? What are you doing here? That you have a kind of...
or where people like go hanging to smoke.
Around, yeah, exactly. It's a bit like hanging around in the kitchen at a party or in the hall or something, that buildings should have those kind of spaces where you're covered from the rain, but you haven't yet got to decide, actually, am I going to go in or will I just hang out?
Do security guards, though, and the presence and need for those, not that it's their fault, but ruin some of those spaces?
They do. That is what is great about Dublin Georgian houses. They're totally plain. There's not much to see because their fabric is continuous. But they have these big, generous platforms and steps, often shared between two houses, which means the neighbours have to say hello to each other when they come out or are brought into a relationship by coming out. And then they step down onto the pavement and then they're in society. So it's just that thing is what says we're in society.
It's a recurring theme.
No, it's the in-between. Yeah.
The lyric in Belfast you did recently. Mm. I love it. Tell me how you went about doing it.
Belfast is a brick city. And when you go to Belfast, you can't ignore it. The fact that it's all made out of brick. It's also, I would say, kind of a pointy place. It's a sharp sort of a place. You wouldn't go to Belfast for smoothness, you know. And then through the middle of Belfast, there's this beautiful, lazy river that seems to ignore everything else as if it's not in the city. It's kind of in the woodland. And our site in the lyric is exactly at the joint between that kind of gridiron Coronation Street, hard brick Belfast and this gorgeous Scandinavia lakeland river that goes through it. And so what we were trying to do in our building was build a site as if it was Belfast. So we built brick houses for the theatres, the three performing spaces of rehearsal and studio and auditorium. And then between those brick lumps, these kind of brick objects, we made this wandering stone stream, which is, you know, the river of the city or the social life of the city.
And there was a kind of challenge. We often find if you get a really tough site, and that site was quite tough, it was very steep slope and the site was very small. So we had to kind of squash the building into the site and we had to bring people up a lot of steps. So this river John's talking about is like a huge flight of stairs. And because everybody had to go up the stairs, or obviously there's a lift, but most people would take the stairs, that's why we made it so wide and so generous, because we felt what people should feel, that the activity of going upstairs is actually enjoyable and spatial and part of the theatricality of arriving and getting ready to go to see a show. So rather than thinking, oh gosh, there's a huge stairs, I've got to traipse up, that they would kind of feel, wow, I'm out and there's people all over the stairs. And there's so very often in architecture that the sort of challenges, the difficult things about, you know, how are we going to get all this onto the site? How are we going to get it to work with that slope? Are the things that then end up giving you special character of the place you're making.
But it's wonderful. We go there now to opening nights and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see it in action.
That's nice for Belfast. Lots of people I know live there like it.
Take possession of it, yeah.
Our starting point was we called it a house for Lyric. We wanted everybody who worked there to feel they were part of the family of Lyric. But also, actually, the client wanted to try and get people there in the daytime, and that's really happened. When you go there, you know, at 11 o'clock and people are having coffee and
it's very nice.
It feels like a lively building.
The Glucksmann in Cork, that's also a lovely building, but that was meant to be a single story, wasn't it? And you convinced them to make
They had a president in the college, Jerry Rickson, a remarkable person, a kind of man of action, and he wanted to do something with the site. It's called the Lower Ground. It's a sort of sacred site down by the river below the beautiful quadrangle in Cork. Because it was a sensitive site, they thought they should build a single story and look at the river and be as if they were invisible. So he asked us to take a look at that site. And we suggested the opposite. We said, if you build the way it's proposed to build, then you will extinguish the very thing that makes it special. You should build a tall building on that site with minimum footprint. And then we just said casually, you know, we said you should keep every single tree on the site. And then that sounded like a promise.
I said, I want something in 10 days. Yeah. I want an image because I'm going to America to do fundraising.
And did you give him an image?
Sheila negotiated 2 weeks. And then we gave him an image and we made an image and we actually only knew what it looked like from one side. When we went into the building committee in UCC and he was about to go off to America to look for money, and he said, John, tell the building committee what the building's going to be like. So I actually had just been reading Seamus Heaney's new book, and so I read Seamus Heaney's poem about the annals say, about the ship in the air above Clonmacnoise getting its anchor snagged on the stone railings below. So I said, maybe our gallery will be like a wooden ship in the air, and we'll make a stone ground and we'll float the ship over the ground and they'll be straining against each other. And the building committee, I don't think, had heard a presentation like that, because there's no drawings, there's only a half of Seamus Heaney poem. And Jerry Rickson went off to America and got the money. A man of action.
And in a strange way, then,
that's what it's like.
The poem really did become a kind of... we find we use words a lot to define what we want to do, and then once you've used the words, it helps you to kind of fix an image to a kind of verbal image. So that poem, combined with actually a Viking ship, which was on display outside the National Museum Kildare Street, which
do
was a ship
that?
it was up in the air. It was held up on a...
When you're not looking at doorsteps, you should look.
I will now.
There's trees outside Kildare Street entrance to the museum, and they put a Viking ship in the trees, and you could walk underneath it, so you could see the under keel of a Viking ship. So beautiful. So that was in our memory. You know.
The other idea, I suppose, was that the building was kind of like a treehouse. It was like a tree itself, and in order to keep the trees and still build the building close to them, we had to really shrink the footprint. So it is like a tree, that the structure goes down in a small in the middle and then it spreads out.
The thing about the trees was that, actually it's true, not a single leaf was damaged in the construction of that project. But the builders, PJ Hegarty's are great builders, and one of the directors said to me, you know, they won't be able to mind the trees the way you think they will. And I said, let me talk to the guys, let me talk to the scaffolding erectors and just let me talk to them. So we all got together on the site, and I said, these trees are older than you, and most of them will live longer than you. And you didn't realise it up to now, but you actually, each of you individually, love these trees. And all these fellows from Cork who had, you know, putting up the scaffolding and walking around the building, they all adopted the trees. So they gently pushed the branches out of their way, because the tree branches touch the building, you know. And if you look out the windows of the Glucksmann, the branches are right there. But just by suggesting to people that they might enter into a love relationship with things that they're working with.
It works.
This works. Yeah. It's an invitation. And the building, I think, so a lot of people go to the site and they don't even see the building. They just see the river, and that's what it's for. It's to reveal the place to itself. Maybe that's what architecture should do. It should make you feel like you're in a place rather than looking at an object, like when you're standing in Merrion Square or... You know, you should feel, what a lovely place this is, instead of thinking about the shape of the building.
Is it more difficult, for instance, Sheila, if you take, for instance, the industrial school in Letterfrack, which had such a sad history of abuse for so many people, and you took that over and you had to turn that into something else? Is that a difficult job?
It is difficult, but it also has the same sort of sense of challenge and conversation that happens. And I think the fact that we had done the Irish Film Centre, which was working on an old building and thought really deeply about that, how to relate old and new, was a good starting point. But of course, that was a perfectly happy old building, the Quaker headquarters. So yes, when we came to Letterfrack, we felt that, in fact, I know certainly when I was a child, we often drove past Letterfrack on family holidays in Connemara, and it was still in use, and you'd pass the railings and there'd be boys inside, and there'd be a kind of a silence would fall in the car and everybody would feel kind of chilled until you were a few miles past it, because you all knew that somehow it was not a happy place. So, and then, of course, by the time we were doing the project, the extent of its unhappiness had been much more exposed and everybody knew what awful things had gone on there. So there's a kind of process of thinking... What is the role of the building in its past? Obviously, the building didn't in itself commit those crimes that were committed against children, but somehow it still carries the memory. Some people thought it should simply be knocked down or erased. I think we felt quite strongly that to erase something isn't really a very good idea, because there's a risk that you then might forget. And it's better to stop and say, okay, this building used to have a terrible use, terrible things happened in it, and I suppose we were interested in the idea of transforming it. And it was, the use was to be a furniture college, so it was for young people, again, 20th and 21st century young people to come and learn and work there in a totally different environment. And it was being run by an amazing community group of people who had bought the building, who were so inspiring. So we thought about, well, there were new buildings to be made and the old building to be transformed. And we felt it was a single project to make these new big workshops for people to work on. Fantastic. They have amazing equipment, amazing standards of work down in the Letterfrack Furniture College, and to make beautiful craftsmanship. But that somehow the old building should also be part of the story. The new buildings were built, some of them, but the other works were not done to the old building. And maybe also very importantly, the ground between the old and the new was not done. And maybe all this talk earlier about doorsteps and stuff is that the landscape, the ground between things, is really a hugely important part of architecture or of place and people's feeling of place. So Letterfrack had a concrete yard, which was the exercise yard for the boys, with an outdoor toilet, which was where they washed and went to the toilet. So part of our idea is we keep the old building, we turn it into design studios. We turn the concrete yard into what we called a kind of learning garden, because we built a new library there and we plant trees and we change a place that was different. But maybe most importantly, we had this idea that the windows, very big windows, but the window sill was above eye level. So in the Letterfrack Industrial School, nobody could see out the window, but also that meant nobody could see in the window. So there was a feeling that the, and this was after actually a lot of thought and analysis, we thought, okay, that's really important, that the building is keeping it, what's inside it, secret. And even if it's only symbolic, the fact that society couldn't see into the school was important. So we thought what we'll do is we'll just drop the sills of every window down to the floor, down to the level of a seat. So we'll keep the windows, we'll keep the shell of the building, but we'll drop the sills so people can see out and people can see in. And therefore, there's a kind of contact between the building and the world outside. And that that connection might change the sense of what the building is. And we also wanted to strip off what we call the brothers' wainscoting, this kind of panelling that's, you know, dark brown, muddy painted timber panelling up to waist height, which goes up the stairs. And we thought if you just strip away the linings, cheer it up, let the light in, let the view out, bring the landscape in, that maybe you can actually just let the air and the light go through the building and sweep away some of the bad stuff.
About that, it's a long time since we've talked about this, but it's definitely one of the frustrations of our own life's work that we didn't do what we meant to do. We were working on two projects at one time. We were working on the Good Shepherd Convent in Cork to turn it into a university. That's an orphanage
and a
Magdalen laundry and a convent in the middle. They're built in about 1887 or so. And exactly the same kind of building, which is the industrial school in Letterfrack. We were working on both of those projects. I mean, I remember walking down the hallway of the laundry in Cork, and you go under a series of Gothic arches, and over one of them is written, you know, behind the paintwork, you can just see written, "Repent or perish," on the way into the laundry. And we came into the laundry and there's ironing boards and piles of detergent in cones, and, you know, and there were rooms with doors with locks on the outside of them and bolts, and it was terrifying.
It was really distressing. That laundry building in Cork,
I think we
was
spent about 10 years awful. Thinking about that task of how to not erase that memory, but how to transform it into a new sort of place. Both of these buildings would be converted into third level colleges. And we were trying to do a kind of social transformation that says, here's another way of looking at the same thing. Mm. Amazingly, the building in Cork, which is on that majestic hill of Sunday's Well, looking back at the city, it's got about 120 metre long facade. You look at it and you think it's formal, it's organised, there's the orphanage, there's the Magdalen laundry. When you look at it closely, there are no doors in the front of the building. So most buildings that are set up like palaces or have entrances, everybody came in that through some little back delivery yard across a bridge, and the women brought into the Magdalen laundries were held in little holding rooms. It said in the annals that we read, it said, until they calmed down. And then they were brought to the dormitories. There was no front door. So there was a building that you can see from the whole city and it has no entrance.
That's so interesting.
So it's a whole, so we thought, open it out mm-hmm. and let the air come in and let's all go in and let's look at what it was like, but let's turn it around.
So how frustrating is it that, is it true neither of those projects got done?
Well, the Cork one, UCC, who were going to make a second campus there, eventually acquired more land near the main campus. They sold it on to someone. Letterfrack, the new buildings were built, and they kind of didn't have enough money to do the work we wanted to do. So they painted the old industrial school and they're using it. But I actually think it's quite important, this idea that you would transform, because I think in a way we also thought that the transformed building would be a kind of a monument to the people who suffered there. Yeah. So it's a way of saying you don't forget, but you don't keep it the way it was either. Mm-hmm. You say now we have different ideas about how to treat children and young people, but we won't forget that these particular young people were abused and their lives were destroyed in these institutions. I mean, they're all over the country, these kind of places. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting question. What do you do?
We're going to take a piece of music, your choice, Sheila, which is the Joni Mitchell.
I think Joni Mitchell was a kind of soundtrack to our lives, probably when we were students and then maybe particularly when we first moved to London. Yeah. And this album, The Hissing of Summer Lawns, which is not one of her better known albums, I think it probably was playing all the time when we lived in Tufnell Park, which John mentioned earlier. And the song that I've chosen, because I love all of it, but is a song called Sweet Bird, which is very beautiful. I was working in central London and cycling home from work every night on my bike through winter and summer. And I remember there was a very long hill from Kentish Town up to Tufnell Park. And I used to chant the last line in my head of this song as a way to get me up the hill every night on the way home. And I didn't really know what the words meant. They became like a sort of a mantra, which were guesses based on what each set of time and change is touching, which she repeats a number of times at the end. So I would just cycle up the hill using this as a kind of way of keeping my legs going round on the bike as I struggled against the wind.
There from Joni Mitchell, your choice, Sheila. What's it like working together if you're married?
I think as the years go by, we've had to develop a few house rules. We're not very good at keeping them, but the rules are supposed to be that we can separate our life out. About 10 years ago, we bought a little cottage in Connemara, and we have a kind of rule now that let's say there's a curtain in the air on the far side of Uachtaráid. And you drive through that curtain and there's no more talk about the office.
Do you stick to that?
Absolutely. That we stick to.
I mean, I think it's in many ways working together is good. I mean, it actually worked really well when we had small children because it meant we could work out the childcare issues between us very well. And if one of us had a meeting or something, the other understood the pressure and would take over and go and collect them or whatever needed to happen. So I think that, well, there's two aspects. One is that I have to say that not all men are as dedicatedly engaged with their children as John was, and we absolutely shared everything, which was fantastic. But the other one, I suppose, is that having the children was also good to help us to set the rules, because before we had kids, we probably would just stay all night in the office if we needed to. But once you have children, you have to go for practical reasons, but also you want to go. And once we got home, the time we had was completely with them. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is actually impossible to think about work, or, you know, you're there playing with or talking to or feeding a 2-year-old child. Work is not in your mind. It just isn't. So, and actually, I think that was, we also decided, OK, we're both working, but once it comes to 6 o'clock, we're going to give them all the time we have to give them. So it probably had a big effect on our social life as well, because we felt if you're a working parent, then what you have to do is really put the time into your children when you're not
when
at work.
Get home. Do you still love what you both do?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very absorbing. I think that's one reason to study architecture, even if you never get to build a building, is that the actual stuff of architecture is so interesting. You have to not think about them as objects. You have to think about buildings as kind of little organisms, social organisms. And once you start to realise they have this wriggling life of their own, they have an animal form of their own, it takes over your life.
I think on balance, yes, I would say that I do love it. And even the things we talked about travelling and seeing things and being able to enjoy the physical world in a way because you're always thinking about the physical world, that everywhere you go, there's this sort of fruit for thought, there's richness, there's beauty to be absorbed. And I think beauty, actually, in hard times, just being able to see beauty in things is so important because it keeps you going.
Do you get eureka moments? Like if you have a project and it's very difficult to know what to do with it, do you sometimes suddenly get an idea and go, that's it, that's how I can do it?
Absolutely. I mean, the world just turns over. You're working away at something you don't know how it's going to solve. Mm. And then actually, it's kind of by magic. Something happens and you think, huh? How did that happen? There is a mystery in the trick of turning something around. And that's one eureka moment. Another is when the rough structure goes up and you see the thing kind of half formed, but not finished. That's also one of the wonders of being an architect. And then we've found, I mean, more recently, because we're getting much older, there's also a satisfying thing about seeing something that's about a long way off, like 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I like going past Ranelagh School and seeing the kids playing in the in the schoolyard. Yeah. And I find at this point my stomach doesn't turn over when I see that. So I think those three moments, the first thought fixed, the first form up when it's still possible to get at it, and then years later when it's kind of relaxed into itself.
It's not that you want your buildings to kind of turn into a background, but when they've just settled into the place they're in and they're just there, that's really interesting. And actually with the school in Ranelagh, a couple of years after it was built, somebody said that to me, that they felt, said, you know, in a way, I know it's a new building, but I kind of feel it's always been there. Mm. And I was really pleased because in a way I thought, OK, that's good. That's what you want. You don't want it to be kind of shouting all the time, saying, look at me, look at me. But another great thing is when you find people are using something in a totally different way than you intended, and they're doing different things, and you think, oh, that's great too, you know, that you intended a space to be used for one thing and people find totally other ways of using it. Because that's also about people taking ownership and, you know, it's theirs to do what they wish with.
What's your favourite building, not designed by yourself, in Ireland?
Oh, I see. I think it depends on, you know, the mood you're in. Like I might, one day I might say, the Rock of Cashel is amazing because it's such a wonderful, well, it's not a building, but it's a wonderful group of buildings which have an incredible kind of relationship with each other and space between them.
When we started our practice first, we started in a little office over Fox's Cigar Shop in College Green between the Bank of Ireland and Trinity College. We had no work, no money, and we had to go up this little spiral stairs and we'd one window looking out. But I still think that College Green is, you come into College Green and you think, I am in the world, you know, this, it's a civilized world and it's a city, and there's something about the shape and the stone and the sweep of College Green. I think that gives me a kick every time I go through it.
Well, that's good. Got two there anyway. You just won the Icon Award in London, and I know you've been nominated for the Huge Sterling Award four times, which is great to be nominated, it even is. If you haven't won it. But winning like that award, the Icon, is that important?
I don't really think awards are all that important, but
they're nice to
but
get, it,
but it's much easier to think they're not important when you win one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
This one is good because it's international, so it's against, you know, the shortlist is from France and South America and
Berlin,
and so it actually puts us a little bit outside our usual scope, and it's nice to be selected in that company. We have a lot of awards, and I think we'd prefer to have projects.
Yes. I mean, awards are, as you say, it's nicer to win them than to lose them. But
work is what you want.
It would be a deception to think that they mean that much in terms of whether what you've done is good or not.
But when you say you prefer to projects, I mean, you both seem to be weathering the storm quite well in terms of the recession.
We're lucky because we're building in London. We have a really exciting project, the London School of Economics, which will be finished later this year. It's taken a long time. And now we're starting on a project in Budapest for a university in the centre of the city, which is really exciting and wonderful. But we'd still quite like to be doing work in Ireland because this is where we live and this is the place that means the most to us. And I don't think there's going to be much work for architects in Ireland in the foreseeable future. But yes, we are surviving. And actually, I think we're optimists. And I think you absolutely have to be an optimist to be an architect. Yeah, it's just essential.
We're going to take a last piece of music, which is the O'Connell's March.
Yes, it's Martin Hayes. We find something about Martin Hayes's music. It really, I think we both just find we're really touched and moved by it. It sort of goes into a whole thing about the culture of Irish music, but it also has resonances of Bach and jazz. And when we're driving up and down to Connemara and we're listening to music in the car, it's like Martin Hayes's music enhances the landscape. It kind of joins with the landscape and makes a kind of a unified experience of something spiritual, maybe.
You'll hear it, but I think you can, if you play it in your mind as if it's a solid thing, you can kind of see it. We got to know him a little bit, and he has said to us that if he hadn't done music, he would have done architecture.
That's why you have a soft
spot
for him.
Thank goodness he did music, because he's such a wonderful musician.
But look, it's been my pleasure to have you today, Sheila and John. Keep up your great work and congratulations on your award. My thanks on sound today to Andrew Kane, to my producer Eileen Herron. We're going to be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we're going out listening to O'Connell's March from Martin Hayes's Under the Moon.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.